Good afternoon and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Corey Shockey from the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, and I know all of you are here to see me, but I'd like to say a few words about Governor Kasich. John Kasich was nine times elected to the House of Representatives, was the chairman of the House Budget Committee when the 1997 balanced budget legislation went through. He has been a superb two-term governor of Ohio, and it is a great privilege that he is here with us at the Commonwealth Club today. Won't you join me in welcoming him to us? So, Governor Kasich, given how many times you have been elected by Americans, I would like to start by asking whether anything feels different to you this political season.
Pretty normal.
I think that people are, obviously very, there a lot of people, not everybody, a lot of people are very angry. Can I stand so I don't fall off this chair? I think there's a lot of them that are angry. They're worried about their jobs, their wages. They're worried about, most important, their kids' future. And then I got upset today. I'm reading that Congress can't figure out how to provide the money for the Zika vaccine. Can they do anything, But that doesn't come because the answer is we just throw everybody out, okay? Because you could put everybody back in and be the same result. The problem is we don't have the leadership that's pulling people together. And we haven't had it there for a very long time. The leaders do not know how to lead, and they don't know how to pull people to a higher purpose, and they're stumbling all over one another. And that's got people upset, but they're fundamentally upset about their economic circumstance. And I get that. And can it be fixed? Yeah, of course it can be fixed. And then you have two ways in which you can run an election. You can double down and talk about how bad everything is, and with no answers to what you're going to do about it. You can just keep saying, we're a bunch of losers. Let me ask you a question. Where would you rather live than in America? We are the creators of inventions. We're the forerunners in all kinds of progress, whether it's medical, nutrition, transportation. Doesn't matter what it is. Everybody's trying to steal our stuff all the time. We're not trying to steal theirs because they don't, because we're the ones that have all the valuable things. And or you can say we're losers and we ought to just, whatever they say. Or we can acknowledge that we have challenges. And Corey, try to give rational solutions. And to me, it's also about the leaders at the top being able to address these economic issues with simple things like common sense regulations and balanced budgets and lower taxes. But there's another issue here that I think really matters. And I'm not sure we ever hear about it or we ever think about it. We have a problem with drugs in San Francisco. Okay. Who are you waiting on to fix it? I was in Medford, Oregon yesterday. I said, what are you waiting on? You have a drug problem here? Oh, yeah, we do. Well, what do you think? I'm going to come in a limousine if I'm president and fix it? You have a problem with education. We're not giving our kids the skills they need to compete in the 21st century? What are you waiting on me? You think I'm going to fix it? You got a problem with poverty? We're not training people who are on relief for jobs that exist? You waiting on me? And I always say I'm going to turn 104 federal programs back to the states, and everybody cheers. They said, well, what's the big deal? That's not going to give you something you don't have now. And there's something that's happened in the country where people either think that they can't fix things or they figure they paid money to somebody else to fix them. And the spirit of our country does not rest in the president. The spirit of our country rests in our families and our communities and in our neighborhoods. And we have to be able to pick up the baton and run with it. And we have to begin to change the world in whatever way we can. And I think that's one of the most important things that needs to be heard today in our country. Because we're waiting for government to do it. We're going to be waiting for, well, it'll never get done. No, I mean, it won't. Am I right about this or wrong? The spirit is in us, I think. So, you know, I think there's this, I wrote a book about the Grand Slam mentality. If I can't hit a home run with the bases loaded, I might as well not bat. Well, every single matters. I mean, everything we do that can live a life bigger than ourselves matters. Yeah, I was in, where the heck was I? I left New York and I was in Pennsylvania. And these two guys run into me in the airport, and they want to take a picture. Quick pick, that's the thing, quick pick. And so I take a picture. I look, I say, what do you guys do? Well, you see us, our little plane out there. We just flew this little boy in here. He's getting treated for cancer here. And there was no other really way to get this boy here. And so we do this all the time. I said, well, I mean, is this your business? No. I said, do they pay you to do this? No. What about your expenses? You get your expense? No, we could get our expenses, but we don't. This is what we do. This is something we can do. Now, are those two guys changing the world? Of course they are. So why don't we just figure out that part of the world that we can change based on the fact that the good Lord has given us some skills and some energy and health to go and help somebody else? Let's go do it. And if all of us do it together, guess what? We're going to see a better place. And that's what I think we need to think more about in this country and not believe that somebody else is going to solve all of our problems.
Can I ask you to say a little bit about what you think Ohio has done particularly well economically in your time as governor, and how that may scale for the country? Talk about the economics in Ohio.
And there isn't anything we do that really isn't scalable, whether it's drugs, whether it's race, whether it's economics, whether it's higher ed. I mean, everything is scalable. We've diversified our state. We've privatized economic development. That's a big deal. We don't run economic development through our bureaucracy, because a bureaucracy would move at the speed. Could we stand down here, Corey? Hey, or right here, so I don't have to fall off that thing.
Sure.
Here's the thing that I would say. We believe that this is the 21st century. Okay, I don't see anybody here. Everybody was polite. Oh, there's one. Let me have that. Okay. This is the world today. Okay. No, this is the world today. And here's what I mean by this.
Hope your screensaver's polite.
It doesn't matter. This is a prop, Corey. This is a prop. Get with the program, Corey. You're supposed to be helping me here. Okay, so what do? We communicate like this. My mother used to say the day will come when we will see the person we're calling on a phone. I'm like, come on, Mom. We buy on this. We are hearing about, you know, we just in San Francisco, the self-driving car. Think about how many people now are, I get more phones this way, by the way. but think about what we hear about in transportation. We're going to have flying cars, and I always knew that was coming when I saw Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. But everything is moving at the speed of light, except two fundamental things that I can think of. One is higher education and K-12 education, which is trapped, I don't know what part of the 20th century, and government. Government does not change. Government does not innovate, because anytime you try to innovate, things get in the way. And then government actually tries to stop innovation. Think about Uber. You know, now everybody's trying to figure out how to restrict them because the taxi union is powerful, right? I mean, I read, by the way, about two cities recently. One is Houston. The other one is Detroit. They have no zoning in many places in those cities, because all zoning does is slow everybody down. And so we privatized economic development. We actually have created a not-for-profit The not-for-profit bought Ohio's liquor business. The state still runs it, but the profits go into this organization. The bonds were sold for very low price because, you know, in good times people drink, and in bad times they drink more. So we pay off these bonds, and now we've hired people who actually understand business. And they're able to target and diversify and drive the strength of our state. We have common sense regulations. I mean, we don't have no regulations, but our regulations are common sense. Secondly, we've cut taxes on business and individuals, and we're running a surplus from, you know, and we're up 420-some thousand jobs. And now we're into workforce big time. We're into trying to match education with people's skills. I mean, it's just been the whole, you know, sort of 360. And then at the same time, we've reformed our criminal justice system. We're paying attention to the mentally ill, the drug addicted, the working poor. Our minority community feels as though they have a role. I mean, it's, you know, we're not perfect by any stretch, but I think we're doing pretty well. And the lesson there is forget politics, look at a problem, be creative, don't worry about reelection, and go solve it. I mean, and pull people together. I mean, how hard is that? I've done it throughout my whole career, and we don't seem to do it anymore because we're trapped by ideology, we're trapped by fear of reelection, and our leaders are not getting people to rise to a higher level.
Enormously
admirable.
She keeps
holding that thing up. Take a few more minutes, Corey. Running for president, so I can add a little bit more time to you. Yes.
Enormously admirable, and yet in very short supply in Washington. Give us a sense about how you would get Congress to play team sports again.
Well, you just work with them, and you show them respect. And first thing I would do would be to call every mother and father who have a son or a daughter in Congress, and then I'd call mom on her birthday, and she'd call her kids and say, or son or daughter, and say, "Don't mess with the president. I really like him." So, but I want to give you a thing I've been talking about lately. You know, in this, you get so bored sometimes doing this. You got to always vary your routine a little bit. You know, but I have this new one that I've been pitching. So, one of the big problems we have in the country is a big overregulation. It's crushing small business. If you look at Dodd-Frank, what we're going to do is we're going to create more big banks and fewer small banks. I mean, it's just so ridiculous, right? We don't want big banks, but we have rules that kill the little guy, so they have to sell to the big person. So here's what I was telling somebody the other day. So here, think about me. I'm the president, right? So I take the two most obscure members of Congress. I call a Republican and I call a Democrat. Hello, the president's calling. Okay, could you come up here at 3:00 today? I'd like to have a meeting with you up here in the White House. What do you think the first thing that those obscure congressmen do when I hang up the phone? What do they do?
They schedule the meeting.
No, that's not what they do. What's the first thing they do? They call their spouse. And then, you know, so then they come down to the White House.
I don't think that's true, actually.
No, that's what they do. And then they come down to the White House and you say to them, because you have to pick the obscure ones. This is what things that people have never understood. If you pick somebody who's obscure, you now, they have rocket fuel. You pick somebody who's already known, they're going to, like, have all these opinions, okay? And they're difficult to work with. So, no, it's true. So you pick somebody really obscure, and here's what you say. My vice president is going to look at unraveling all the federal regulations across the federal government, which is what we do in Ohio. Now, I'm going to put a package together that I'm going to have to push through the House of Representatives. And I was wondering maybe if you would want to work with us on this. And then you get to do it, and I can announce the president. I'll say your name. We'll have a press conference, and then we'll have the package, and then you work it through. And then I say, okay, is that all right? Yeah, great. Okay, shake your hand. Then they leave. What do you think the first thing it is they do once they get outside the White House grounds? Call their spouse. You say, you cannot believe what just happened, okay? Now you've got two people who are already the strongest advocates for what you want to do. And they will build a team, and then you just say, look, bring the rest of your team down. Let's have a Let's have a drink tonight at 6 o'clock. We'll be on the, you know, just come on down to White House. We'll just hang out for a little while. That's what you do. We don't do any of that. We haven't done it forever. And then everybody gets frustrated. It's ridiculous. So anyway, that's what I would do. Is that all right, Corey?
Excellent. It's a reminder
that
politics is how stuff gets done.
Go ahead.
So we have a terrific lineup of questioners.
Oh, we do?
Yes, indeed. And I'm going to give the first question, which is going to be on healthcare, to Dan Oppenheim. Where are you?
Here. Don Oppenheim, but I'm a bad writer, I guess.
you are a bad
Okay, spell. So here's the question. And I should say you're the only Republican I'd ever really consider voting for. And with seriousness, the Republican mantra on Obamacare is repeal. You can't get elected if you're Republican at any level if you don't say that. So the question is, how would you phase it out and not harm 11 million people who are covered under it?
Well, look, I mean, the problem with Obamacare is it fails to do three things. It doesn't control the rapidly increasing cost of health care. Number two, it's driven up the cost of health insurance in my state by 80% on average. And small businesses don't want to expand because they could get caught in the web. Other than that, it looks like it's working great, okay? Now, there's one provision that I like, and that is no one should lose health insurance because of a pre-existing condition, and that ought to be carried on forever, okay? Now, what I want to do is, sir, I want to have complete transparency. You know, in my state, our city of Columbus, Ohio, we have more heart hospitals than we have hearts, okay? Now, we also don't know how our hospitals are doing, and neither do you. You have no clue whether the Stanford hospital system is better than the, you know, some other hospital. You really don't know. You think it is, but you can't tell me why you think that. Because there's no transparency. You don't know what things cost, and you don't know the quality. It's the only thing I can think of that we do in our lives where we shop without any knowledge of price. And so we don't know what. Yeah, let me give you another one. So if this gentleman is in San Francisco, and he has a knee replacement, and this gentleman has one in San Jose, and they're identical, this will be 10,000 more than his. We have no clue why. We talk to each other at parties like, oh my, why'd that happen? Because we don't know. We don't really know how good our physicians are, and we don't know what their prices are. So what we're doing with the help of the Cleveland Clinic and all the health organizations in our state is we are moving forward with complete transparency, quality and price measured at every level. And then what we intend to do is if you are below the mean in quality and price, we will give you a financial reward. If you're a hospital and you reduce the number of readmissions, if you reduce medical mistakes, if you're in a position of you don't have high infection rates and your prices are low but your quality is high, we will make it worth your while. The same thing is true with our primary care doctors. If the primary care doctor, she or he, keeps the cost of your health care down, you have high quality, and it's below the median, they get a financial reward. Everybody is involved in this, insurance companies, the health care providers, because I think we all know that if we don't get a control with market transparency, things are going to continue to gyrate out of control, and we'll end up with rationing.
So you repealed it on day one. I just want to know.
I put all that in.
And that's great. I just want to know what happens to those 11 million.
That's a good question there. I'm sorry I missed that. We would take some of the federal resources that are available now, combine it with the state Medicaid resources, which I would send to the states, and you could create your own state exchange, and you should cover the 11.5 million who are the working poor. That's what we would do. But we have to move beyond that quickly to this issue of transparency, market, and driving down, putting downward pressure on these health care costs. What's so interesting about it is we're going to do this in Medicaid for sure, but I've convened the meetings, and my guys have, they're smarter than I am, they've convened these meetings with the health care professionals, and they're all buying into this, and they all want to do it. because they know that if they don't do it, things are not going to work over time. And that's precisely where we're headed. And that's absolutely scalable to the federal level. Okay?
Christine Kasharian, you're next up. Christine Kasharian, you're next up.
It's an honor to be standing right in front of you, Governor Kasich.
Oh, come on.
As a Republican and as a woman,
thank you,
I would like
by
the way. To know, do you have an alternative to Planned Parenthood, given that you have recently signed a bill to defund it, but also is known to support the welfare net?
Well, of course, we are not going to reduce. You know, the problem, I didn't figure this out till somebody said defund Planned Parenthood. It means like defund. No, that's not what we're doing. We're not going to reduce any of our health care services, women's health care services at all. Some of them are going to be in hospitals. Some will be in the federal clinics. I mean, they will be available to people because women's health is critical. Now, I also have expanded Medicaid in Ohio, something that, believe it or not, Ronald Reagan did five times. And sort of funny, like in every debate, the conservative columnist tried to say, you expanded Medicaid. Oh, my goodness. And then I would answer them, and everybody would cheer, so they'd go on to the next question. But the interesting thing is, by doing that, we've extended health care to over 330,000 women who didn't get health care before we expanded. So we're absolutely committed to, I mean, the health of our women in the state of Ohio, and we will continue to pursue that. Okay? Thank you.
Michael Lundgren.
Good afternoon, Governor. Thank you for coming. As Corey said, my name is Michael Lundgren. I'm a 16-year-old sophomore in high school at St. Ignatius College Prep in the Sunset. And my question for you is on the economy. So small community banks are the lifeblood of small businesses. And unfortunately, costly regulations are suffocating these community banks and hindering small business growth. As president, what will you do to support community banks and small businesses?
I think I've already answered that.
Well, you did kind of address it, but more specific. Sorry,
now
I wrote
this
beforehand.
You're 16 years old?
Yeah.
If we worry about the future, this is a perfect example of what I see all across the country. They're poised, they're smart, and they are they don't give up, okay?
Well done.
And they are the ones who really need to know that in their lives they were made special. And they have to believe that they can change the world. We'd have to have some regulations that impose legitimate restraints on the big banks so that, you know, whether it's equity requirements instead of all debt, whether it's, you know, then make sure we do these stress tests, make sure that they have plenty of liquidity. You know what all those things are? Okay, but that's what we need to do. Get back and write that down. Get, and have your teacher call me. We'll give you an A. And and then we've got to make sure we're not overburdening the small banks that spend all their time trying to figure out all the regulations. Okay? What do you want to be when you get older?
Well, hopefully I'd like to be a public servant like you. I really admire your
Yay.
Career.
Okay.
And
well, you know, I have two girls who are 16. They're twins.
And I'm also a twin. My twin sister is sitting in the
okay,
back row.
Okay, good. Good. So when when Anderson Cooper asked my daughter, Reese, whether she wants to go into politics, she said, maybe, but I want to make a lot of money first. Remember, take advice from my daughter, Reese. Okay.
So while we are on the subject of the youth of America, could you say something about the sustainability of Social Security? And
yeah, that's no problem. That's not a problem. You fix Social Security simple. You just say that if you've made, you know, my friend Ted Schlein is here today. He's over at Kleiner Perkins. Ted is not going to get as much Social Security as he would be entitled to, and he's going to get less. And so the people who, you know, who are not making much money will get their Social Security. That's the end of it. It's just nothing more than means testing it, period, end of story. You don't have to raise a retirement age. That's what you do. These are not hard problems. The problem is the politics of getting people to stop attacking one another and using all these wedge issues. So I was reading a little bit more about this Zika virus. So now the Democrats are saying the Republicans don't care. Republicans are saying we've given you more money than what you've asked. I don't know what the truth is. Can you just go fix it? Get them in a room. Where's the president? You know, we've just gone through this whole business of encryption. I don't know if we're through it or not. I can't figure it out. But here's what I know. I know there is nobody in the technology industry that doesn't have a concern about the security concerns of America. And I know there's no one in the intelligence I shouldn't say that, but I doubt there is many in the intelligence community who don't realize that we need to have civil liberties. So what the president just gets them in a room. You want to deal with your water problem out here? Get people in a room. And you say, you lock the inside and you lock the outside. And you barricade the outside and you say, ain't coming out till you come out here with a solution. That's how you do things. Everybody gives. Everybody gives a little bit, okay? And if you wonder if that's possible, I balanced the federal budget with Senator Domenici when the Clinton administration was in power. You just work it out. You just get it worked out. And we're not doing enough of that today.
Why do you think, given that the national debt has doubled since 2007, why has debt played such a small role in this electoral campaign?
Because people don't know what it means. I go on college campuses. Here's what I tell students. You know, we have $19 trillion in debt. I said, when the debt clock, because I carry a debt clock, I'm like really a little strange. I have
a
debt clock that I
carry
around, you know.
It's really nerdy.
Yeah, and so... You can figure I'm pretty nerdy, aren't I? Yeah, right. So anyway, when I tell the students, and I tell everybody, when the debt goes up, the jobs go down. When the debt goes down, the jobs go up. That's all it is. It's pretty simple. Now, I tell them, I say, you know, we want free stuff. I want free Ben and Jerry's. Bernie wants free college. Hillary wants whatever Bernie wants so she can win the next primary. And... So you know what? You want all that free stuff? The debt will be $30 trillion. Now, you're going to get a lot of free stuff. You're going to get a free college education, but you're never going to get a job. So pick what you want. You want a job or do you want free stuff? And, no, I mean, it's simple. I worked on the balanced budget for, I don't know, 25 years. I've been connected to this, and I never figured out the bumper sticker. Well, it's real simple. Debt goes up, jobs go down. Debt goes down, jobs go up. It's true, because anybody who's a small business person will tell you when they look at the debt situation, they become less willing to invest because the earth is shaking, right, Steve? The earth shakes and people are like, well, I don't know that I want to do that. I'm not going to take a chance. It's not complicated. So why doesn't it play a big role? Because people don't understand why it matters. And that's okay. That's up to some leaders to talk about. I don't spend a lot of time talking about it other than to point that out to people.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California Town Hall program with Governor John Kasich of Ohio. Our next questioner is Kelly Bryan.
Hello, Governor. My name is Kelly Bryan. I'm a proud resident of San Francisco. Do you believe that some people are born gay? I'm a 62-year-old gay man who came out to both of my parents at 19, and I've been gay for over 40 years. Gay people are human beings and not a lifestyle choice. Please respond without prayer being an answer.
I think we all be better off in this country if we prayed more. I don't know what that means. I'll tell you what religion means to me. Religion's about the do's and not the don'ts. Religion for me is about, you know, loving somebody who doesn't like you, humility, love your neighbor as yourself, treat your spouse better, live a life bigger than yourself. And all the don'ts come like down the road, and that comes to everybody as they spend more time thinking about their eternal destiny, and they can figure that out. And in terms of me, I don't believe in discrimination. I think there is a balance, however, between discrimination and people's religious liberties. But I think we should just try to like take a chill pill, relax, and try to get along with one another a little bit better instead of trying to write some law to solve a problem that doesn't, frankly, exist in big enough numbers to justify more lawmaking. So, you know, I mean...
Republicans don't believe in marriage equality. It's your platform.
Well, is it?
Yes.
I haven't read that thing lately.
Well, you should know what you're doing.
Okay. Well, no, they don't tell me what to do by the platform. The Republican Party is my vehicle and not my master. Okay, I have a right to define the Republican Party, too. Okay? Now, I got to tell you, sir, I believe in traditional marriage. I just went to a gay wedding. A buddy of mine just got married. My wife and I went to the wedding. It was great. It was fine.
But do you feel, do you
but
know
I'm not going to go for some
people
constitutional
are born
amendment.
Gay.
I'm not going to get into all the analysis of this or that. I'm not going to do that.
It's not analysis. Are people born gay?
Our next question.
You know, sir, probably. I mean, I don't know how it all works, okay? I mean, look, are they? In all probability, they are, okay? Well, you have free regular rights. We're not denying you any rights. I'm not in Ohio. I'm not out to discriminate against you. I think you ought to have as good a life as anybody else. I can't. Can I be more clear than that?
You're,
but I'm not in Kentucky.
Mississippi.
I'm not in favor
Our
of
next
this.
Questioner.
No. Let me finish. I'm not in favor of that. I'm not in favor of discrimination against anybody.
But they're using religion.
Well, but they are not me. Okay? They are not me. I'm telling you my view. Okay? I want to tell you this. I don't agree with gay marriage, but I went to a gay wedding. Okay? I mean, that's what I've done. And I'm not for saying because you happen to be gay that somehow somebody should hold something against you. Now, here's the question. So somebody has deep religious beliefs. So you go to, and I've talked about this repeatedly, you go to somebody who's a photographer, you want him to come and be the photographer for the gay wedding. The guy who's a photographer, the woman says, yeah, I'd really rather not do that, kind of against my principles. So my feeling is, well, find another photographer. Let me give you another one. So if I'm making cakes and somebody comes in and says, I mean, first of all, I don't think they come in and announce what their feeling is, but say they come in and say, you know, I'm gay, I'd like to have a cake. Sell them a cake. You know, that's kind of, I mean, we cannot be pushing each other's buttons. And we need to just, we don't want to discriminate anybody, but we also don't want to run over anybody's religious, you know, deeply held religious beliefs either. So I think there's a balance, sir. And here's what I would tell you. If I saw that this was becoming this huge problem, then we might have to write a law. But every time somebody writes a law around this subject, guess what happens? You have to rewrite the law because they never get it right. So let's just, like, respect one another a little bit more, tolerate each other's individual beliefs. And I'm not going to sign any laws in Ohio that is going to create a discrimination against anybody. And do I think that people are born gay? Probably. I've never studied the issue. But I don't see any reason to hurt you or discriminate you or make you feel bad or make you feel like a second-class citizen. I don't think that's right. Because you know what? Everybody's created in the image of the Lord. And I don't... So, one other thing. Sometimes people say that they're religious, okay? Just because I say that I'm a Ford Falcon doesn't make me one. Don't you understand what that means? Just because I say I'm faithful doesn't mean that I am. Just because I make a statement. And don't put everybody who you think, you know, has religion and believes in God, don't put everybody in the same barrel. Because I'm telling you how I feel about things. And I woke up today and talked to my minister today and tried to say some prayers today. You know what I'm praying for? Lord, let me be a better guy because I'm a screwball. And secondly, I'll try to do what you want me to do with my life. That's it. That's what my prayer today. So God bless you. Okay? Thank you. All right.
And now the next questioner, Annette Perry.
Well, you don't want to skip over these things, right? I mean, he's concerned, and I appreciate it.
Hi. My question is, how would you approach the Syria issue? Specifically, how would you get Assad out of power and yet stabilize the country of Syria?
Not by using U.S. troops. I don't believe in civil war. I want Assad to go. We've let time, water, has gone under the bridge. We should have been supporting the rebels in Syria long ago. We should have enforced the red line. We should have created no-fly zones. I would support the opposition in Syria, but I would not want to use U.S. forces in the middle of a civil war. But I would use U.S. forces in Syria against ISIS as part of a coalition, and that has to be done quickly. We are dripping ourselves into both Iraq and Syria, and we're taking this piecemeal approach that doesn't resolve anything, that delays the action that ultimately must be taken, and it will make it more costly and more complicated. The time has come to take decisive action against ISIS, to destroy them, and finally sit down with our friends in Europe and tell them to get a life and to cut all this bureaucracy where they can't even figure out how to talk to one another. I mean, think about the people that died as a result that nobody in Belgium had the good sense to take the message from Turkey and to be prepared for the introduction of this radical jihadist in Belgium. We need to get that all cleaned up over there, and we need to provide the leadership, and I think NATO ought to be a policing and intelligence gathering organization, and we need to bring the entire civilized world together to fight these barbarians wherever they are in any part of this globe, because these folks are out to destroy us just because we breathe, just because we live, and they believe their trip to paradise is based on our destruction. It's a terrible, terrible situation, and we need to act quickly and not slowly. Okay?
So, so the things you say you want to have happen in Syria strike me as exceedingly unlikely to happen without American troops.
Yeah, we need
the
American
glue that
troops.
Do that.
Yeah, we have to have troops.
And yet you started saying no American troops in Syria.
Not for purposes of removing Assad and being in the middle of a civil war. There's a distinction between being involved in a civil war and taking collective action to destroy ISIS. But I would not be marching U.S. I don't believe in civil wars and America getting in the middle of them. And they never seem to work out. Furthermore, I would like over time to be able to get out of Afghanistan. I don't think we should sit there for another 25 years. And what we ought to be doing is giving them the aircraft that they need. But understand, U.S. forces in Syria designed to eliminate or remove Assad is an entirely different proposition than U.S. forces in Syria designed to go to Raqqa, destroy ISIS, go to Iraq and destroy ISIS. And then once it settles down, I'm for coming home. Okay?
I can't resist one last follow-up on that. Given that Assad and the Russians are killing the very rebels you would have fight ISIS. Mm-hmm. How do you square that circle? How do you destroy ISIS when the Assad government is keeping them moving as a justification for killing the rebels?
Well, look, I mean, first of all, you know, Turkey now understands this, and we're actually working more closely with Turkey. And they may be trying to kill the rebels, but they're not killing all the rebels. We also now are providing more aid, but we also have people on the ground aiding the rebels. I would have started this thing a long time ago. I called John McCain and John Boehner a year and a half ago and said, I'm the governor, but you know, anything I can do to support aid to the rebels, to remove Assad, to break the link with Iran, and then, of course, Russia gets in the middle of it. But you have a lot of forces in there. And some days Assad's doing better, and other days Assad's doing worse. So the Russians were beginning to leave. Now they've reasserted themselves again. You know, the Russians, one minute they say they want to fight terrorism, and sometimes they do, and other times they don't. It's pretty darn complicated. But I think we keep our eye on the ball, but I am not in favor of the U.S. intervening in civil wars. We tried to do it in Lebanon. It didn't work. Hillary Clinton made a terrible mistake by pushing Gaddafi out of Libya, which has now created another foothold for ISIS. Stay out of civil wars. You can help the people that you're for. Take Ukraine. I would be for arming the Ukrainians so they could defend themselves. But I am not for putting U.S. troops in Ukraine. But I will tell you this. We ought to make it clear to Putin that if he wants to do something to disrupt the Baltics, he's looking at a problem with us directly. So you have to think about these things in a separate way. And how do I know about these? Well, I've been working on these issues for most of my adult lifetime, because most people don't know. I served on the Defense Committee for 18 years in Washington, and enough said about my bragging.
Our next questioner is Lewis Brodman.
It's actually Lewis Brickman. I guess I didn't write it well enough either. I'm a college student here at Minerva Schools, which is this new university trying to actually change what's wrong with our higher education system. And my question is, and I know you touched on this a little bit, but how do you plan on tackling the rising costs of higher education and the huge size of student loans nationwide? What are some of the specifics there?
Well, first of all, there ought to be more young students thinking about going to a community college rather than a four-year school for at least a year or two. You can cut your costs in half. So that's one really good alternative. You know, you go to some of these schools, they're $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year. You go to a community college, it's $4,000 a year. 2 years, it's $8,000 or $9,000 or $10,000. You're in another school, it's $120,000. I think we need to start thinking about that, about what we can afford. Secondly, I think we need to have a way for students who graduate from high school to be prepared to go to college rather than to spend their time taking remedial math and English when they get to college, paying tuition for something they should have learned in the 11th grade. And I think we can resolve a lot of that with online education and ability to get up to snuff. And then I would say, in addition to that, in my state, which I would do nationally, we need to get the smartest business people we can find, the men and women who are going to look at taking the cost drivers out of higher education. Because I tell you what's going to happen, in my opinion. These schools are going to close. We are going to have some sort of an online education combined with a real-world college experience at a fraction of the cost. And these universities, it costs $50,000, $60,000, now they're going higher, are going to be disintermediated with technology, with a real campus experience. And then the savings you make can allow you to do spring breaks for the rest of your life, wherever you want to go. Now, in addition to that, if we keep putting more money into higher education, they'll keep raising their prices. We cannot continue this. So we need to get university leaders who are serious about taking out college costs. Now, why is it that many of them don't do it? Do you know why? If you're a university president today, what do you think you want to be tomorrow?
I do not know.
A university president, okay? And, you know, the president of Ohio State, Gordon Gies, now at West Virginia University, where he first started, he wanted to lease all of the parking garages at Ohio State. The first question is, why is Ohio State running a parking garage? I mean, I thought their job was to educate students. So he wanted to lease this, and but many in the university community really opposed him. He did it anyway, and he got $500 million for a lease, which he put into scholarships. Now, Bowling Green used to have a dining hall program. They don't have one anymore. They privatized it. How do you think the food is now?
Better.
How do you think the prices are?
Lower.
And how many students you think are taking advantage?
More.
That's because you're at that conservative think tank at Stanford. That's why you said that. But that was absolutely perfect. And that's exactly what's happened. I mean, let me give you another question. Why do universities build dormitories? Can you explain that to me? Why would they be in the dormitory business? I'll bet there are developers here who could build dormitories that are much more efficient, much more student-friendly, and probably less expensive. And, you know, why do we do this, Steve? Because we've always done it, I think. So I think we need to take a look at all the non-academic assets, and then, you know, it might even be a good thing for a professor to teach more than, like, one course a year. I know they don't like that. I also think that we should have our universities and their research actually mean something and shouldn't be just to put a stack of stuff together and put it on a shelf and find it 40 years later. I think the universities, along, by the way, with our national laboratories, ought to be really friendly and user-friendly to our businesses. And the same holds true for basic health research, you know, like the National Institutes of Health. If we give money to higher education, they better not put it into overhead. They love overhead money. Okay? So I just think we've got to do that as well. And then we face a problem that's real, that's very real. And that is we have a lot of young people who are carrying massive debt. And some would argue that it's holding back their ability to really engage in entrepreneurship. If we could figure out a way to begin to control the cost of higher education, I'm open to any creative idea about how we can have them work off some of that debt so they can kind of be rescued from it. But we can't just wipe it out and then the universities just raise up their prices again. We need fundamental change. And then let's get a group of smart people together and think about some creative ways. You know, they're doing it, you know what they're doing at Purdue, where a student can, you know, sort of make an agreement with somebody that they would give a percentage of their future salary in exchange for help with tuition. I don't know about that. It's interesting. I don't think any idea ought to be off the table when it applies to higher ed and its dramatically rising costs.
Next up, Will Garlington.
Let me ask you a question. What do you think about that, all that I said?
I think that universities are medieval institutions, and we are overdue to make them much more creative and entrepreneurial by serving our students better.
Okay, you're hired. I'm president. You'll be one of the people on the task force where we're going to look at this stuff. And see, this is like, it's like we need a balanced budget amendment to the U.S. Constitution because it will force Congress to do its job. We need a task force that forces the university presidents to make these changes. And if you have a task force and you have a set of rules, it's like they can say, I really didn't want to do this, but they're making me. And we really ought to hold the university boards of trustees. They ought to be somewhat not financially liable, but there ought to be a certain responsibility that they sign up to whenever they get on the board of a university. And maybe they ought to sign the financial statements. You know, I don't know. But these are things we need to think about.
Next up, Will Garlington.
I'm a 13-year-old going to school in Marin right now, and my question regards the environment. So how would you make economic sense out of imposing stricter limitations for environmentally damaging industries in the U.S.?
Well, you know, there aren't many industries that really want to wreck the environment. I don't happen to believe that. There are things that are done that we would really wish weren't done, and we need to have reasonable laws that, you know, I mean, I'm not for, like, getting rid of the EPA, but I can tell you that the EPA has, you know, sometimes put in regulations that are destructive for employment. I assume you're 13 years old and you're going to be 18 and you're going to do something and then you're going to want to get a job, and I'd like you to be able to get a job. I do believe there is climate change, but I think we should go about this in a reasonable way. We ought to be able to continue to provide some of the incentives that we have for the development of renewables. But the big key here and the big solution ultimately is battery technology, the ability to store energy, the ability to have distributed power. These are the things that are really exciting that can change the very way we live. And so I like that. So I believe in wind and solar and geothermal. I believe in efficiency. But you know how efficiency works. You got to pay $5 more per window. Well, maybe we ought to go with the $3 more window, right? I mean, efficiency is tough, but we need to have efficiency standards. We've made some gains. We need to make more. So I would say all of the above is what's important to us when it comes to the environment. And the environment is precious. It needs to be protected. It is not to be worshipped. Okay?
Next up, Julia Kahn.
Hi, I'm Julia. As a teenager growing up in Silicon Valley, the role of technology and the importance of predicting its effects on society has always been made very clearly important. How can the federal government adapt to be better suited to roll out effective cybersecurity measures?
Well, we got people that are experts in it, and we need to make sure that we have to strengthen our cyber command. We've got to make sure that we're in a position to be able to defend and also in a position to be able to destroy those that seek to destroy us. And it's just a matter of a presidential initiative. Let me tell you one other problem we have in this country. If you work in the private sector, and I'm the president, and I call you and ask you, will you come and help me solve a problem in the government? You're likely to say no. I mean, unless you're Floyd Kwame, you're probably going to say no, okay? Why is that? Well, you have to sell your firstborn to be able to work for the government. They want to know everything. So we need to have a clearinghouse. We need to have a place where, whether it's cyber, it doesn't matter what it is, restructuring the VA, okay, flattening the structure of the VA. We need to have people who can come in and help without making it so difficult that they immediately say, the government wants me to come and help? Forget about it. I'm not interested. And if we can do that, we're going to have some sort of a clearing process, because we do not want to ignore or exclude the smartest people we have in the country, because we make it so difficult for them to help us. So this is going to be an initiative that I would take on if I were president, and I think it's really, really important. So we need to take advantage of the fine minds in Silicon Valley and in the state of Ohio.
Next up, Peter Kaysen.
Thank you for being here, Governor Kasich. I'm a Democrat. I'm a big fan of bipartisan solutions to solve big problems. And one of the more hopeful trends is left, right, and center getting together to work on criminal justice reform. What would criminal justice reform look like in a Kasich administration?
Well, I think it's fundamentally done in the states. We've already done it. You know, we don't want to lock everybody up. The three strikes and you're out. We need to review all of that. And we don't want to be putting nonviolent felons in prison. And we don't want to, you know, nonviolent felons are, you know, some of these young people that may have asked a question who do something dumb, and then it's sort of held against them forever. I think it's really important when we have judges, and I appoint judges in Ohio. You know, what's important there, and one of the questions, and I don't have litmus tests for judges. I mean, I want somebody who's fundamentally conservative, competent, somebody that we respect. But one of the questions I get concerned about is if you have a nonviolent felon, a nonviolent drug user, and you know in the next election that they may say you're soft on crime, will you put that person in prison rather than put them in a more appropriate setting based on whether you lose an election or not? And the fact is we don't want to we can't lock our way out of this problem. So I not only have we reformed this and with a conservative legislature, but we've now just moved to ban the box, which is something that keeps people from being able to apply in government. And we can't do it in the private sector, but in government we ban the box. You find out if somebody was a felon, but a little bit farther down the road. What else can I tell you? That's kind of my approach to it. And I like what Michael Vick said. You know what he said? You only have one chance to make a good second impression. Now, our recidivism rate in Ohio is about less than half the national average. And why is that? Because if people want to work their way out of prison into a skill, we'll allow them to do it. And by the way, one of the most important groups we have in our prison are the prison ministry, because it's allowed people to say they have hope, that they're important, that they're made special. So we use all of that to get ourselves in a position of where people can at least believe that they and know that they can have a second chance. Now, if they're violent, if they're gangbangers, if they're drug dealers, forget it. Okay, but for other people, we'll give them a chance. And George Will has chronicled some of the things. Look, if you don't have a good team, you don't get anywhere. I got the best corrections guy in the country. And he's terrific. And so I let him kind of do his job, and he tells me what he's doing, and it's working pretty well. Okay? We also, by the way, are treating the drug addicted in the prison. Now, the surveys we've done are relatively narrow, but what we have found is that when we treat the drug addicted in prison and we release them into the community with proper follow-up, the recidivism rate is less than 20%. Now, we'll see if the numbers grow. The numbers are narrow right now, so I don't want to draw a complete conclusion, but it's going in the right direction. It's pretty remarkable. Okay?
So, Governor Kasich, trade has not had a good election cycle so far. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your view on trade, mm-hmm. how trade deals from NAFTA to China joining the WTO have affected right. jobs in Ohio, what your judgment is on trade.
Well, our economy has grown significant since NAFTA. Most of these trade deals are designed to reduce the barriers of other countries. Now, I grew up in Pittsburgh, where, you know, I saw steel mills, you know, kind of be destroyed, and trade is the easiest thing for me to say is that trade is bad. You know, we ought to lock our doors and pull down the blinds and leave NATO, and don't even get me going on all this. But let me ask you a question, sir. Do you remember when Japanese cars came into the United States?
Yes.
And what happened to American cars?
American cars should have gotten the competition and should have gotten better, but I'm not sure that that was true.
Well, that was partially good, okay? No, American cars got dramatically better as a result of competition. I mean, what trade does is it brings in competition. Now, I don't know anything that stagnates that's good. I can't think of anything. And with blocking competition, you get stagnation, you don't get innovation, and things are not good for consumers. We pay more price, and the products are shoddy. Now, I would also tell you, typical of the government. So I run a steel company, and I know the South Koreans are dumping steel, in other words, selling steel, here against me at a price less than what it cost them to make it. Yesterday I was with a timber guy who's telling me about Chinese imports. So here's what you do. You say, oh, yeah, they're cheating. So you have to gather all this information, okay? I want to take you on this trip through the government. And you're gathering all this information. You gather. How's it going? You take these big bags of information and you fly them down to Washington and you give them to the people who are supposed to determine whether it's been a trade violation. And then maybe, you know, then they study, and then they have to, of course, check with the State Department to figure out if they're going to step on somebody's toes for some political reason, even though somebody's job's being destroyed. And by the time we get around to it, we have a very bad result. People have lost their jobs. I think we need an early warning system, and I think we need to be able to take action and levy countervailing duties when we suspect that there are trade violations. And we know when we're seeing them. And this government seems incapable. Look, we're stuck in the 20th century, early 20th century, I swear, so we can't get anything done quickly. We can't answer the suicide hotline at the VA. Did you see the latest thing about the, we all want more defense spending, right? Did you see what the services said? We have more infrastructure than we can possibly need, and we'd like to get rid of it, and the Congress says no. Okay? I mean, when I was a congressman, if you wanted to go to the White House, you'd have to apply about 2 months before. Now you just jump over the fence, okay? These things, see, it's simple. It's common sense. And when you hear me talk and you say, because some of you are thinking, well, it can't be that simple. I run the seventh largest state in America. I went to New York once I was elected. I met with the rating agencies. They said, Ohio is dead. We're going to end up downgrading you. I said, give me a chance. We were running a 20% hole in our operating budget. We had lost 350,000 jobs. Our credit was on the verge of being downgraded. And where are we today? We're up 420,000 jobs. We're running a $2 billion surplus. Our credit is rock solid, and our outlook has been improved. And we've diversified Ohio's economy, and the wages are growing faster than the national average. Yeah, it works. It works.
Next up, Steve,
you know, it'd be really great if in the election to elect the president that these things actually mattered.
Here.
Huh? Wouldn't that be good?
Steve Cadavar, where are you?
Thank you, Governor, for being with us today. The Atlantic Magazine month of May cover story is, and I quote, "The secret shame."
I read it.
of the middle class, nearly half of Americans would have trouble finding $400 in a crisis, unquote. Governor, at least one presidential candidate calls for political revolution to address fundamentally this problem. How do you see to solve the problem of this magnitude, if not by a political revolution that includes the middle class?
Okay. Thank you, first of all, everybody ought to read the full story and not draw a conclusion from. Did anybody else read that article? What did you think about that article?
I thought it was spot on.
Did you?
Yep.
What did you think?
The same as, even though it was so shocking.
I looked at the story, and I wanted to read the cover. I was searching for the magazine before it actually came out, and I read it, and it's not as simple as what that headline is. There's a lot of different reasons for it. The only reason why I would say that is I don't want to pander. The guy got bulk of money. He didn't get paid on a regular basis. At one point, he owned two homes, two of them in New York, I think. Okay, I mean, hello, that's not easy. But that's not most Americans. Now, are Americans in a position where they feel they're falling behind? Yes. Yes, they are. Okay? So why is that? Well, first of all, if you look at the Federal Reserve and what they've been doing for a lot of years now, they've had these low interest rates, which allowed companies to borrow, write off debt, buy back stock, and so people who have money bought the stock. Their net worth has increased, while people who don't have the money to do that have not gone up. So you have a widening, okay, between the rich and the poor. Secondly, it used to be you put your money in a bank, and at least you got interest. You have the seniors talk about, I'm not earning anything, and that's another consequence of the interest rate policies of the Fed. But you're not going to want to, maybe people don't want to hear this. When you have 0.5% growth in America, when you have the lousiest recovery out of recession since World War II, why are we surprised that we're getting sick? You know, I mean, the rich, let's talk about the rich for a second. My dad carried mail on his back. I said, Daddy, what do we think about the rich? He said, Johnny, we don't hate the rich. We want to be the rich, okay? Secondly, I just do not believe that redistributing wealth is a good thing. I don't think it's worked anywhere. Our problem is we don't have any leadership, and we have no economic growth. Now, if all of a sudden you have economic growth and people are healthier, they can invest. Now, we all know that investment in America in businesses is like at a historic low. Nobody's investing. They're buying back stock. And they're not sure about consumer demand, so they're not making additional investments. Now, when companies do not invest, wages never go up, productivity doesn't go up, and we got a mess. And why is that happening? We're killing them on regulation. We're raising everybody's taxes, and we can't control our spending. Well, you know, so you go to a doctor, you say, Doctor, I'm the doctor of economics. What do you want? So, well, okay, if you want to grow an economy, you got to balance budgets, cut taxes, and have common sense regulations. So you come back a year later, and you say, well, I don't feel very good. I said, well, what have you been doing? Well, I've overregulated, I've overtaxed, and I've overspent. He goes, well, isn't it amazing that you're not feeling well? So the first thing we have to do is to address this economics. Congress doesn't want to balance a budget. Without good leadership, they won't do it. The reason they won't do it is they're spenders. They buy, you know, John Kennedy was passing out silver dollars when he was running for public office. He said, well, Mr. Kennedy, you get elected, you could pass out the people's money. So we got to control that. Now, here's the other thing. Let me ask you this question. Is our education system, K-12 in America today, preparing our young people for the jobs of today and tomorrow? Is it?
No.
Okay, well, then what are you waiting on? I mean, you want me to fix it? Look, I called my wife. I said, I'm in San Francisco. It's absolutely gorgeous. And she said, why am I not there? Okay? I said, it's this little thing about these two girls, okay? And I'm working. I'm going to see the inside of hotel rooms, okay? But
He means his daughters for anybody who, in this election cycle, missed that joke.
I mean, seriously, what are we waiting on? I mean, we have all these initiatives in California where we're going to fix all the education, put all this money in. All these rich guys put all this money in, and what happens? Nothing. So you know what I'd suggest? Start taking it school by school. And by the way, if you want to be a school reformer, I'm going to give you a tip. I want you to stand right here, okay, and I want you to run as hard as you can into that wall. And then on the fourth time, there'll be a crack, maybe. We need to do it where we live. So if kids don't have skills, you know, I'm a big fan, everybody is, of, well, not everybody, but Charles Barkley's not, but I like this Steph Curry. Now, why is he going to make $1 billion? He's got skills. I don't think we're giving kids skills, and I don't think our K-12 education system is flexible to be creative and imaginative. I'll give you an example. If I'm good in math and I'm in school and I don't know what I want to do, I put that kid with this guy right here, Ted Schlein. He's one of the greatest security software experts in the world. And I let that kid hang out with him a few, 3 or 4 hours a week, change his life. We're not doing that. We're too inflexible. And so that's part of it. The other part of it is we need to have lifelong education. We need to constantly upgrade our skills. We have 170,000 job openings in Ohio, can't fill them. First question that businesses ask all the time, do you have a workforce? We're now customizing workforce because people don't have the skills because we're not constantly doing this. Now, I don't know how we're going to pay for this, Corey, but we have to make sure that people are going to have full lifetime ability to get trained, to improve their skills. So I was in Rochester, New York. They told me that the Oreo cookie plant was going to move to Mexico. Okay, that's a terrible thing. People working in there. You know, I was in Medford, Oregon. There's 600 people that work in a lumber factory. I'm with the guy who owns the lumber factory. So, you know, you shut that thing down, you're going to blow a hole in the side of Medford. But here's the question, and they're investing, by the way, $20 million into their operation there, which means that workers will do better. Now, it's terrible what's happened to the people who work at the Oreo cookie factory, but here's what I would want people to think about. Would you rather make Oreo cookies or would you rather make computer chips? So we need to, we're in this very difficult transition right now where this economy is changing. And you can't ignore the pain of people who are being subject to the change. It's hard, but if I were to tell you I got some magic answer, which is I'm going to tax Poisoner more and give to somebody else, it ain't going to work. It just won't work. So I just think between Federal Reserve, federal policies, skills that you're in charge of, and lifelong education, I think those are the things that make us more valuable, that give us more productivity, and you know productivity and wages, they're directly connected. High productivity, high wages, low productivity, low wages. Am I right, Mr. Kwame? It's the way it works.
And on that virtuoso note, my friends, I must draw this special meeting of the Commonwealth Club of San Francisco to a close.
I know. Well, listen, thank you all. You're so kind.
Join me in thanking Governor Kasich.
Thanks, Corey.